in a somewhat less than satisfactory manner, Macintosh-based software. This only extended the life of the doomed Lisa, which would never receive proper credit as the immediate progenitor of the Mac. Steve Jobs, however, won few friends when he informed the newly disenfranchised Lisa group that he considered most of them to be inferior players on Apple's team. Now that Jobs was general manager of the company's most important group, a group with disappointing sales no less, Apple's board of directors could hardly continue to overlook his deficiencies. Thus began a drama that would lead to Jobs' expulsion from the company he co-founded. Through much of 1984, there were few outward signs of trouble. Scully and Jobs were a mutual admiration society, gushing to anyone who would listen how much they were learning from each other. A year after the Macintosh launch, they were on stage at the Flint Auditorium again, demonstrating what they called the Macintosh Office. It did feature a wondrous addition to Apple's product line, an expensive laser printer that would immeasurably improve the quality of computer-produced documents. But the other pieces, particularly the file server, which was the heart of the system itself, simply were not there. Not just incomplete, but non-existent. Jobs seemed to be living a fantasy wherein Apple's fortunes glowed. Joanna Hoffman, who in late 1984 had been transferred from international to domestic marketing, received a shock when she attended her first high-level meeting with Jobs. She was instructed to prepare a company-wide forecast. But the numbers she was given for Macintosh sales were, she realized, not the actual number of units sold, but the original, hopelessly optimistic predictions made in early 1984. Nobody had the guts to tell Steve that his original forecasts were stupid, Hoffman told me. The real numbers could not be ignored, however, and soon Apple's board of directors began to think that either Steve Jobs or John Sculley, or both, had to go. After a few months of stunned quiescence, Sculley began to fight for his job. He would keep it by neutering Steve Jobs. Jobs, for his part, argued that his leadership was necessary to maintain Apple's status as a visionary institution. The business press covered the struggle as if it were a combination of Greek tragedy and soap opera. John Sculley was consumed with overthrowing the man most deeply associated with the company, the man who had lured him from his executive position at PepsiCo, seduced him, as Sculley would later concede. Months before, they were the Siamese twins of Cupertino. Their grinning pusses graced the late 1985 cover of Business Week, and in the background, a Hawaiian sunset framed them like Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald. The dynamic duo, read the headline. Now their relationship had descended to vicious memos and clandestine conferences, as Sculley tried to move Jobs somewhere in the company where he couldn't screw things up. Unlike the clash between Jobs and Jeff Raskin, which had implications for the direction of personal computer technology itself, this was no more than a boardroom drama, a power struggle to win the support of a bunch of Apple's directors. The outcome owed everything to the bottom line. For the first time ever, the company took a quarterly loss. Apple was about to lay off 20% of its workforce. The board decided finally that Jobs was the problem. Sculley was at fault, too, for not asserting himself, for sticking too close to the orbit of the wunderkind who had plugged him from Pepsi. But the board believed Sculley could right himself and bring serious coin to Cupertino. On May 31, 1985, as Sculley later told me with steel in his eyes, I fired him. Jobs retained the title of chairman of the board, and there was some blather about a role as the champion of Apple's spirit, but in truth, he was forcibly exiled from the Macintosh building to some other structure, where the phones may as well have been disconnected. After a summer of limbo, Jobs stood up at a board meeting and announced he was off to start a new company. It's obvious I've got to do something, he said. I'm 30 years old. He called his new computer company Next. It made no dent in the universe.
Chapter 9. As the Macintosh struggled through 1984, the man who would help save it was quietly traveling around the country with a small stack of the new Sony floppy disks. His name was Paul Brainard. He was based in Seattle, but he had nothing to do with that area's software giant, Microsoft. Few had even heard of his company, named after an obscure Italian who lived 500 years before the first Happy Mac showed up on a monitor. One day that summer, I was hanging out at the West Coast office of Byte magazine when Brainerd turned up. He was a gangly man with large glasses, short yet unruly blonde hair, and enthusiasm about software that made him seem more like a techie than a businessman. His discs held an alpha version of PageMaker, a program his newly formed company was developing for the Macintosh. An alpha program is sort of a rough draft of a finished application. Not till software is in the subsequent beta stage is it ready for even preliminary evaluation. Though the program was buggy, it crashed several times during the demo, a common alpha ailment, it was clear that Paul Brainerd's excitement was justified. Brainerd had once been a newspaper editor, but more recently had been an executive for Atex, the company that made terminals for newspapers and magazines that had gone computer. He prided himself on being familiar with both editorial and technological aspects of publishing. He saw the field itself at a crossroads. The wave of the future seemed to be high-end machines designed to produce and lay out display ads for newspapers. You would install 8 of these at around $50,000 or $60,000 per workstation, Brainerd later recalled. They were designed for expert use only. There was a minimum 30-day training course. They were not very intuitive. Brainerd knew enough about technology to realize something the bigger companies did not, that all the benefits offered by those expensive workstations soon could be provided by low-cost personal computers. Brainerd began thinking about how a software application could duplicate the work of those deluxe machines and more. The concept required getting a number of things right, he later said. Lowering the cost, yes, but also lowering the barriers that made them hard to use. In January 1984, coincidentally, the month that Apple introduced Macintosh, Brainerd was out of a job. Kodak had bought out Atex, and the Seattle operation was shut down. Brainerd recruited 4 engineers from the ranks of his former colleagues and started a company. They weren't sure which microcomputer would be the platform for the application to spearhead the new field that Brainerd dubbed desktop publishing. In retrospect, it seems inevitable that he would find the Macintosh. It was the only personal computer on which the screen display was the same as the final result. What you see is what you get. It was also, by far, the easiest computer to use. What if laying out a publication were as easy as using Mac Paint? With Macintosh technology, almost anyone could actually produce a sophisticated document with a small computer. Yet it was almost haphazard the way Brainerd became linked to the Mac. Driving around the Northwest soon after the Macintosh launch, he and a couple of his company's co-founders decided to make a cold call to Apple's office in Beaverton, Oregon, just to see this supposedly amazing computer for themselves. The local representative promised to visit them in Seattle. He not only kept his promise, but showed up with a Macintosh in the trunk of his car. "Why don't you guys play with it?" he asked. "I don't need it for 6 weeks or so." That local rep might have saved Apple. Exposing Brainerd and crew to Mac magic clinched the deal. Desktop publishing would be implemented on the Macintosh, and not the IBM PC. Brainerd's program, PageMaker, would be Mac all the way. It was only after that experience that Paul Brainerd, at the suggestion of publishing technology guru Jonathan Siebold, was introduced to people at Apple who filled him in on an Apple secret, the LaserWriter. Since 1983, Apple had been busily designing an advanced laser printer, much like the sophisticated photocopier-style computer printers that sold for around $30,000. Apple's would cost around $7,000. I admit that when Jobs first explained this to me in late 1983, I was startled. I wasn't sure how many personal computer owners would buy a printer that cost over twice as much as Macintosh itself, no matter how great it was. But Jobs assured me that releasing this printer was going to be one of the smartest things Apple had ever done. The chairman did not mention that at one point he had adamantly opposed the project. Burl Smith had designed the logic board of the LaserWriter. He approached it as if he were designing a new computer. In terms of his innards, the new printer was a computer, a monitorless Macintosh, only much more powerful than the standard Mac. Its version of the Mac 68000 Motorola processor made it run 50% faster than the Macintosh. It also had 3 times the memory of a fat Mac. But Apple's smartest design decision concerned the manner in which the printer produced its documents. instead of exclusively accepting the quick draw routines utilized by the standard Apple printer, the LaserWriter also made use of something called a page description language, called PostScript, created by software wizards who had recently left Xerox PARC to form a company called Adobe. When a Macintosh program was equipped with PostScript, a visual display of the document would be embedded in a series of instructions. Issuing a print command would send those instructions to the printer, which would interpret them to create the document. This technique was especially powerful in generating typefaces and fonts. PostScript stored those as mathematical formulas. This was not only faster than using bitmaps, but much more flexible. A simple tweak could, with very little computation required, change the style from normal to bold, or switch the point size from 3 points, very small, to banner size, all designed without the dreaded jaggies that normally characterized output generated from the computer. Instead of using its own knockoff fonts, as it did in Macintosh itself, Apple licensed the traditional fonts Times Roman and Helvetica for inclusion in every LaserWriter. In addition, Adobe marketed entire typeface libraries which could be downloaded into the machine's memory. PostScript was versatile, and using it, you could generate an array of stunning effects, like words swirling in a spiral. Best of all, PostScript commands could be read not only by LaserWriters, but other sorts of printers, including professional quality linotype machines. So if you had a PostScript file in a program like Paul Brainerd's PageMaker, you could send it directly to the big machine that prints out newspapers and magazines. A business person's desk in a small office could now be a complete print shop. All along, the designers of Macintosh had said that they could not predict the nature of the revolutions it would ignite. That task would be up to its developers. PageMaker was the evidence, a revolution in publishing. PageMaker was amazing. It allowed you to venture into Mac's enclosed world, manipulate columns of text and pictures to create beautiful page layouts, and emerge from the information scape with a finished publication in hand. I was once an editor of a weekly newspaper. I still shudder recalling the recurring nightmare of Tuesdays when we went to the art house to lay out the paper. Our typewritten stories would have been specced, given specifications for typesetting, and sent there the day before, along with the pictures we thought we'd use, and of course, the allegedly photo-ready advertisements our staff had solicited. Upon arrival, we would paste some of the blank boards on an angled table, and then begin laying out our tabloid page by page. People working the linotype machine would hand us the columns of text, along with the headlines, and we'd figure out what looked good, and begin fixing things down to the boards, using hot wax to hold them down. We'd take a column of text, size it to the page, and snip the excess to be jumped to another page. It was like a jigsaw puzzle with no set solution except adherence to the principles of design as best we understood them. After a first pass, adjustments began. We'd resize the pictures, sometimes flopping them. We'd fix typos in the copy. We'd rewrite headlines. Someone would call in a change to an ad. Every time an adjustment was necessary, we would give the instructions to the overworked craftspeople at the shop, and they would go back to their incredibly expensive machines, returning an hour or so later with a change. This would continue until very late in the day. By then it was usually well into the night, when the accumulated changes threatened to throw the whole system into gridlock. At a certain point, we would stop trying to make the layout better and just do what we could to get the hell out of the place. This liberation usually took place about daybreak on Wednesday. In the summer of 1984, when I watched Brainerd put the alpha version PageMaker through his paces, I understood that future editors of weekly newspapers would no longer see the sunrise when they left the art shop. There would be no more art shops. The whole operation had been compressed into the virtual reality of Macintosh. PageMaker's metaphor was the pasteboard. You laid out your publication by selecting a text file and pasting it on the page. The text flowed into neat columns, with any excess clearly marked, ready to be moved to a jump page. Nuisance tasks became automated. At our weekly paper, we almost always flubbed one of the page numbers or date lines, but PageMaker remembered these things. The greatest benefit was the elimination of the penalty previously exacted for corrections or changes. Everything on the virtual pasteboard had the malleability of thought itself, so changes that previously took hours could be performed in milliseconds. Want a headline bigger? A mouse click on a menu item would do it. Resize a picture? grab the edge of it with your cursor and pull. See a typo? Fix it. As in VisiCalc, PageMaker's improved efficiency only hinted at its real value. Its true strength was in modeling. The cost of trying new things bordered on zero. You could virtually publish 1,000 editions in cyberspace before you printed a single one. It was even feasible, at the last minute, to rip up the entire layout and try something different. If you suddenly wondered what the page would look like if you blew up the graphic 150% and wrapped text around it, you could actually see how it looked without squandering an investment of time and money. No wax on your fingers either. Only a few years before, Cold Type, the switch from hot lead to electronic typesetting and layout on pasteboards, had been posed as both a technological villain and savior in the publishing industry, rendering generations of craftspeople obsolete while cutting costs drastically. Now, the entire structure of the cold type process was doomed. It was only a matter of time before professional publishers would switch to desktop publishing. As new refinements to desktop publishing came online, it became possible to perform very sophisticated tasks with Macintosh, even color separations and digital editing of high-quality photographs. Glossy magazines and high-circulation newspapers would be desktop published, as would this book. Breakthroughs like PageMaker have two sorts of effects. The first is to increase the ease and reduce the cost of performing previously expensive, time-consuming tasks. The second, and possibly more significant, is to empower people who otherwise could never afford to do the task in the first place. With little more trouble and not much more money than it took to mimeograph a newsletter where the text sat on the page like a dead perch, anyone could now produce something with the panache and visual challenge of a professionally produced publication. Lives were changed. I once interviewed Elliot Cohen, a young man working for the county government in Queens, who secretly lusted to become a sports writer. With a Macintosh and desktop publishing tools, he appointed himself editor, publisher, and art director of a newsletter analyzing trends in New York Mets baseball. He sent it unsolicited to team executives and baseball writers, and even managed to sell a few subscriptions. Showing the newsletter to PR representatives of Major League Baseball teams, he was able to convince them to grant him press credentials. He soon found himself in the locker room at Shea, interviewing Howard Johnson and Doc Gooden. Writers began to call him for comments, and eventually, editors of other publications gave him work. He cheerfully shared the credit for his career change to Macintosh. Hunter Thompson once said, "When the going gets weird, the weird turn pro." Macintosh empowered anyone and everyone with the tools to turn pro. When seeking a name for the new company, Paul Brainerd and his colleagues wanted to choose something that would not only reflect the content of the product, but its open-ended creative power as well. One day, they took some time out from calling on newspaper customers and visited the main library at Oregon State University. The reference librarian pointed Brainerd and his colleagues to some texts on the history of printing. One of them dealt with a 15th-century Italian scholar and printer named Aldus Manutius. Not exactly a household word. But as Brainerd learned more about this relatively obscure Renaissance figure, he realized he was the perfect icon for his company. Manutius was born in the small village of Bassiano in 1449 or so. Historians don't agree on exactly which year. Very little about Manutius is known for certain until, at around age 40, he abandoned scholarly pursuits in Rome, Ferrara, and Carpi and went to Venice to practice the nascent publishing trade. He instantly made his mark with a series of books based on the classics. Compared to previous printing efforts, these Aldine editions were relatively inexpensive, efficiently designed, and compact, probably the first pocket-sized printed books. His volumes were groundbreaking in the same sort of way Macintosh was. In both cases, the entry point for an exciting new technology was significantly lowered. Manutius is now recognized by the Cognoscenti as the father of the modern book. In addition, he is credited with the invention of italic type. This is a significant association, considering that Macintosh would allow millions of people to ditch the underlines they were using in their documents to emphasize words and phrases, replacing them with real italics, just like the magazines and books they read. It was perfect. Brainerd called this company Aldus. Brainerd, of course, was not the first Macintosh developer to call upon a classical personage for inspiration. Something about Macintosh cried out for lofty comparisons. The technological architects who designed Macintosh consciously intended their creation to initiate, in John Sculley's words, a second renaissance, wherein their marvelous tool would enable creativity to explode, spilling over business documents and electronic doodles like a Grouchy fireworks display. So it was no surprise that the original renaissance would be tapped for ideas. A typical product name for a Mac application? Da Vinci. This same sort of fervor, in fact, characterized the people who purchased Macintosh in the first years. Though Apple was disappointed that only 250,000 or so people had bought Macintosh in 1984, those who did buy were determined to convince the world they had made a clever, perhaps brilliant decision. Even if others could not see much of a future for Macintosh, they did. A similar blind enthusiasm persisted in the community of software developers who had been thoroughly evangelized by Apple's authorized cheerleaders. Macintosh evangelist Guy Kawasaki came to realize that, with the exception of Microsoft, the key contributions to the still languishing Mac software base would come not from already established companies, but hungry startups excited by the possibilities of the friendly Mac interface. Apple was desperate for the Macintosh equivalent of VisiCalc, something so valuable that people would buy the computer solely to run it. It had high expectations for Lotus's product. After all, Lotus 1-2-3 had been the IBM PC's VisiCalc, but Lotus's Jazz turned out to be a dud. Mitch Kapor's charges had clumsily missed the point of Macintosh. In the Lotus view, Mac was a computer for beginners, for electronic dilettantes who still clung to a terror of technology. So Jazz was the equivalent of a grade school primer, an ensemble of crippled little applications that work well together but were only minimally useful. No one bought it. A little later, Microsoft got it right. It used Macintosh to create Excel, what it considered the most powerful spreadsheet on any computer of any kind, and Excel became an immediate bestseller. The great new products for Macintosh came from little companies like Living Video Text, which sold a program called Think Tank that let you create dynamic outlines, or a company named Tello Software, which made File Vision, a database that used pictures to organize records. In 1985, the darkest days of Macintosh, the evangelizing began to pay dividends. Mac developers had spent over a year learning the difficult process of mastering the Mac toolbox and creating a new sort of application, and were excited about what they had wrought. In August of that year, they gathered in Boston for the first iteration of what would become a semi-annual powwow on insane greatness, the Macworld Expo. Despite all indications the Mac was doomed, sales were still dismal, the atmosphere was that of a high-tech Mardi Gras, a celebration so steeped in excitement that even the most pessimistic pundits began hedging their bets. It was a harbinger for a turnaround. Only a month before, on July 15, 1985, Aldus had sent out the finished version of PageMaker. The Macintosh finally had its VisiCalc, an application worth buying a computer for. By that time, Apple was somewhat belatedly throwing all its support to the new application. Originally, Aldus's most helpful contacts at Apple were involved in marketing the LaserWriter, who wanted an example, any example, of an application that would make use of Apple's expensive new toy. But several months before PageMaker shipped, Apple began viewing the concept of desktop publishing in a different light, as something that could bolster the flagging sales of Macintosh itself. Brainerd's liaison at Apple asked them to prepare a marketing report on the concept of desktop publishing. This 20-page white paper went directly to John Sculley. In the months that followed, Apple paid close attention to Aldus, and when PageMaker shipped, Apple paid some of its marketing costs. Everything from cross-country press tours to advertisements in the Wall Street Journal. Apple was desperate to differentiate Macintosh from the IBM PC, Brainerd recalls. Desktop publishing was their only viable option. It worked. Brainerd recalls visiting potential corporate buyers who at first would sneer when he pulled the Macintosh out of the case. "That's a toy," they would say. Then he would run PageMaker, and it would become clear that the toy was a tool, at least as far as producing visually attractive documents was concerned. to appease the in-house publication people, people who by then were salivating with anticipation, the company would reluctantly agree to buy a couple of Macintoshes and LaserWriters. And a strange thing happened. The anti-Macintosh arguments of the Management Information Services dweebs slowly began to lose currency. The superiority of the Macintosh system would win converts. The workers in the publishing division would discover that spreadsheets and word processors on Macintosh operated with the same intuitive charm as PageMaker and benefited from the consistency built into the Macintosh from the start. Colleagues from marketing, from publicity, from the executive suites, often people who normally loathe computers, would wander over and get a feel for this computer, try out the mouse, and become seduced themselves. They would recommend that the company augment its desktop publishing Macintoshes with Macs devoted to more conventional applications. You would see the pattern, recalled Brainerd. A large corporation would buy PageMaker and a couple Macs to do the company newsletter. The next year you'd come back, and there would be 30 Macintoshes. The year after that, 300. Though this process was initially more of a deus ex machina than a conscious strategy on Apple's part, the company belatedly arrived on a name for the process, the Trojan Niche. It was as good a description as any for the way desktop publishing saved Macintosh's skin. Not long after PageMaker shipped, Apple began overcoming its engineering inertia. By January 1986, the Macintosh Plus was ready. At first glance, it was much like the original, but the most severe criticisms of the original were successfully addressed. At last, there was sufficient memory, a megabyte. There was a new drive for the floppy disks that allowed each disk to store twice the information. And the innards of the machine had changed, too. The tired remnants of the Mac team, including Brian Howard and Larry Kenyon, had beefed up Andy Hertzfeld's ROM so the Macintosh Plus could smoothly accommodate the hard disk drives that would be plugged into a special high-speed port on the back of the box. Apple offered its own model for sale, but dozens of third parties very quickly had versions of their drives. The Mac Plus even had a new keyboard, with cursor keys. Though bigger and better improvements were in the works, the Plus was a major milestone. While the original Macintosh was a visionary computer, you had to be a visionary to appreciate it. In an effort to create what he called a crankless computer, Steve Jobs had eliminated the crank of a steep learning curve, but replaced it with a new crank, insufficient memory and storage. Now, that crank was gone. Only when the configuration of a Mac Plus and hard disk drive became standard could the Macintosh switch on the ignition and fly. John Sculley was now in charge of Apple, which essentially meant that he was in charge of Macintosh. Though the Apple II family still brought in more revenues than the newer machine, Sculley and everyone else knew that Apple's original computer, introduced 11 years before, was an old dog, well into its fade towards oblivion. This was clear despite the fanfare given the latest slick incarnation of the machine, the 2C, introduced by a blowout event with banners proclaiming, "Apple II forever." If Apple was to have any future at all, it had to keep improving Macintosh so that impressive new applications like PageMaker and Excel would be able to fulfill their potential. All along, the goal for Macintosh had been to establish the computer as an industry standard alongside DOS, the inferior but widely accepted IBM and Microsoft system. It still wasn't clear that this was possible. Perhaps the DOS lead was insurmountable. There were two drastic alternatives available to Sculley. He resisted both. One was to license Macintosh's operating system to any takers. The experience of IBM showed that when competitors, especially Japanese and Korean hardware companies, could produce clones of your computers, most of your customers would abandon you for the cheaper goods. No, the system software, the soul of the Mac, was Apple's crown jewel and would remain closely held. A less onerous approach would have been to drop the price of Macintosh, making less money per unit, but selling many more computers and increasing the Mac's market share. One need only to visit a computer dealership and watch a first-time buyer to understand the virtues of this strategy. It's not clear Sculley ever did this. On one side of the store were several different models of the toady machines that ran MS-DOS, including the very low-priced clones of the IBM PC. On the other side was Macintosh, gorgeous, a bit exotic, and clearly superior to the competition. The entry-level Macintosh, however, cost almost twice as much. It was not obvious to novice buyers, or even experienced ones, that the higher initial cost would be amortized by hundreds of hours of more pleasurable and effective computing. So Apple lost millions of customers and forever lost its chance to gain a significant market share. Scully didn't price Macintosh competitively until 1990, and by then, Apple was destined to be forever the other computer, with no more than a significant but small plurality of users. It was a hesitation that would ultimately cost Scully his job. Still, in the formative years of Macintosh, Scully was actively remaking Apple into a large and successful company. At every turn, he attempted to distinguish his leadership from the swashbuckling legacy of Steve Jobs. While he celebrated the achievement of the Mac team, he disdained the pirate ethic that drove them. The heroic style, the lone cowboy on horseback, is not the figure we worship anymore at Apple, he wrote in his autobiography. Originally, heroes at Apple were the hackers and engineers who created the products. Now, more teams are heroes. This was not exactly true. A close look at the manner in which the key products evolved at Apple in the Scully era shows an interesting pattern. Time and again, the crucial advances were made by individuals or pairs of wizards who passionately followed their instincts, often pursuing their goals even after their managers had canceled the projects. This was partially a result of the management style of the man charged with producing the next generation of Macintosh technology, Jean-Louis Gasset. He was the first, and by far the most prominent, of many of the protégés John Scully would pluck from the ranks of Apple executives, most often from Apple outposts abroad, and occasionally from other duller companies. Scully would latch onto these golden boys with a fickle intensity that studio executives bestowed on a Hollywood flavor of the month. For a year, perhaps even two, this or that executive would be touted as a dynamic presence on the Apple team. And then, one of Scully's fabled and frequent corporate reorganizations, reorgs, would displace the stunned executive. Gasset was for a long time the exception, the only one with a personality that even began to address the charisma gap opened by Jobs' departure. He was a Frenchman, darkly handsome and dripping with Gallic self-assurance, a noir visionary in leather, a businessman who seemed to fancy himself a combination of Belmondo, Sartre, and Tom Watson. As head of Apple's French operations, he had outsold IBM, in the process shaping his own persona as a generic symbol for the future. His face turned up in Vogue, and he made commercials for mineral water. He had even written a book called The Third Apple, which was not merely a book he wrote, but an invitation to voyage into a region of the mind where technology and poetry exist side by side, feeding each other. One of the phrases that technology fed to poetry, or was it the other way around, was that the Apple II smelled like infinity. But Gasset was no mere blowhard. He understood what it meant to be an emissary of Macintosh. You had to channel magic. He knew that in the wake of Steve Jobs' traumatic departure, a sense of play was missing in Cupertino. He believed one reason Apple was suffering in 1985 was that it had somehow abandoned its roots. Though he loved the Macintosh, he felt it lacked some of the features that had made the Apple II the leader of its day. These included color and slots. Certainly, color display monitors had always been planned for Macintosh, but this capability had been shelved because it would make the original Mac too expensive. Slots were more controversial. A slot is actually a socket on the main logic board inside the computer. If a computer has slots, wireheads describe it as open. That is, the computational core of the machine, the bus, can be accessed through those slots. You do this by plugging in special circuit boards. These boards have various functions. Some enable you to network with other machines, some enhance video quality, some add memory, some add processing speed, others may include the equivalent of a whole new computer, allowing, for instance, a Macintosh to behave like an IBM PC so you could run software for either machine. The Apple II was famous for its slots. People cracked the case open all the time and stuck a variety of weird cards into the six slots. They loved the intimate contact the process afforded with the exotic-looking chips and resistors in the Apple's viscera. But the original Macintosh, by Steve Jobs' fiat, was slotless. Jobs thought slots were inelegant, a remnant from homebrew hobbyist days, where the first instinct of the mad scientist hacker types there would be to jack up the hood and critique the bus. There was also a practical reason for disdaining slots: system crashes. It's much easier to write robust or stable applications programs if you know that everyone's computer is configured the same way. Once that consistency is lost, every time a program runs, it has to be instructed thoroughly about the configuration on this particular computer at this particular moment. It's a mess. And this is partially a reason why both the Apple II and the IBM PC were temperamental machines. Jobs was convinced that the ports in the back of the Macintosh were sufficient to handle any peripheral that Macintosh users would need. After all, the Mac was for knowledge workers, not wonks. For that reason, Apple broke tradition and did not include a programming language along with the machine. Macintosh was for drivers, not repairmen. In fact, Mac owners were sternly informed that only authorized dealers should attempt to open the case. Those flouting this ban were threatened with a potentially lethal electric shock. Talk about a forcing device. Gasse reversed all this. He wanted a Macintosh with color, big monitors, and slots. He wanted a powerful machine that would impress even the macho MIS workers who were still snubbing the Mac. Gasse himself had more than a streak of the same sort of machismo. He made no bones about his desire for power, for openness, for slots. He considered it one of his features, not a bug. He presented the prospect to Apple's customers as a solemn vow. The license plate on his Datsun 280Z read, "Open Mac." The only problem was delivering the goods. Here is where Scully's team concept broke down. Scully envisioned the new Apple as a cluster of team players, each squadron consisting not only of engineers, but marketers, human resources people, and bean counters. But the road to the new Macintosh, or the Macintosh 2, as it would be called, was less a cooperative effort and more like a road rally on Baja, a long, rutted, unmarked trailway dotted with broken-down 4x4s. Ever since the original Mac had shipped, various Apple hardware artists have been trying to hatch a supercharged sequel, but somehow, with the boardroom politics, Scully's frequent reorgs, and the steady exodus of disenchanted wizards, their projects languished. There was Burrell Smith's Turbo Mac, and then Burrell was gone. There was the Big Mac of Rich Page, the designer of Lisa, and then Steve Jobs cajoled Page into being one of the next team. There was another mysterious Macintosh called Jonathan, but that also somehow found itself by the wayside. And then there was the dark horse in the field. It was called Little Big Mac. Its auteur was a wispy, bearded engineer in his 20s named Mike Dewey. He had been most recently associated with Apple's file server, an essential component of the so-called Macintosh Office announced in January 1985. The product was never completed. Its failure was a shorthand for the fortunes of Apple in early 1985. Dewey believed that out of the file server's ashes should come Macintosh 2, or as he called it, Little Big Mac, an expandable Macintosh. The proposal came solely from his own initiative. He simply wanted to be the person who designed Apple's next computer, and he began doing it. He hooked up with a hardware designer named Brian Berkeley, whose thinking was parallel to his, and the two of them embarked on what they called an underground thing. Though Dewey drove a Porsche and Berkeley was a Mercedes man, the pair got along well, swapping design notes and stuffing boards. Fearful of Steve Jobs' loathing of slots, however, they kept things quiet. In their memos, they never used the S-word. Apple's product czar, Jean-Louis Gasse, came across the project and benignly permitted it to continue, albeit as sort of a background skunkworks, as Dewey later put it. Looking at a photo in Dewey's cubicle of the engineer's hometown skyline, the Frenchman renamed the project Milwaukee. Subsequent code names of the Macintosh 2 included Reno, in honor of the slots, the overly militaristic Uzi, and ultimately Paris, an homage to Gasse. For the next few months, the designers tried to figure out which features to put on their computer, hoping it would win out over the other potential open Macs going at Apple. There were false starts. After some vacillation, Dewey decided that the Mac's original microprocessor was underpowered for a color machine. The next generation, Motorola's 68020, would be required. Until very late in the process, Berkeley dictated that the power supply would be placed in the monitor, a surprisingly wrong-headed solution that would have limited the range of screen options available to Mac 2 users. Gasse finally made his decision on which of the digital contestants would become Mac's big brother. "It was a question of people," Gasse said. "I felt that Mike Dewey was capable of doing it." Instantly, the other projects were backburnered or axed, and a phalanx of analog designers, software wizards, hardware nerds, ROM ninjas, and marketers were on the case. A champion was anointed to manage the project. T-shirts were printed, parties thrown, deadlines set, and missed. Nothing approaching the original Macintosh's constant time to completion, but still worrisome. November 1986 became January 1987, and finally March. By then it was clear that the Macintosh 2 would be the biggest thing in Macintosh since the Macintosh. Not that the two could be compared. The original Macintosh was the anomaly, created by those eager to roil the surface of history. That was a strength. Its failing came in the inevitable shortfall between reach and grasp. Under Scully and Gasse, Apple concentrated on the grasp part of the equation. Having produced what its artists wanted, the job from then on was to satisfy customers. The original artists of Banley 3 would sniff derisively at each iteration of the technology they had wrought, but ultimately came to admit that the impact from their labors would only be realized when more people used it. Steve Jobs, when working on the original Mac, thought that he was right and didn't care what the market wanted. "It's like he thought everyone wanted to buy a size 9 shoe," said Dewey in 1987 when his creation was officially released. The Mac 2 is specifically a market-driven machine, rather than what we wanted for ourselves. "My job as an engineer is to take all the market needs and make the best computer. It's sort of like musicians. If they make music only to satisfy their own needs, they might lose their audience." At the same time Apple introduced the Mac 2, its first modular Mac with separate monitor, it also unveiled the SE, a variation on the distinctive original shape compact Mac family. The SE was similar to a Mac Plus, but with cosmetic variations such as a color change from beige to a lighter shade called platinum, a slightly faster processor, and the main wrinkle, a single slot. Despite the latter, users of compact Macs were still warned to allow only authorized dealers to open the case. Over the next few years, Apple would introduce a steady stream of new Macintosh models. With each one, Apple strengthened its contention that the mission of Macintosh was finally on course. Yet the press conferences for introducing these models were often testy affairs, and continuing bone of contention was Apple's insistence of charging top dollar for its computers. Few would let Apple forget that it had introduced Macintosh as the computer for the rest of us, and wound up selling computers that often cost 50% more than its competitors. In 1989, for instance, when Jean-Louis Gasse unveiled the SE30, a compact Mac with a more powerful processing chip at its heart, the Frenchman parried the journalistic thrusts with an edge of hostility. "We don't want to castrate our computers to make them inexpensive," he responded icily to one question about price. "We make Hondas. We don't make Yugos." Fortunately for Gasse and Apple, yet another isolated team of heroes with hopes of designing the next Macintosh had been forging on despite the wishes of management. This was a duo consisting of H.L. Chung, an engineer who had originally been hired in Singapore, and Paul Baker, who had once worked on the Lisa, left Apple to work for Jeff Raskin's ill-fated information appliance company, and returned. Scully and Gasse had just canceled Chung and Baker's project, which was built around the vision of making high-quality Macintoshes for a much lower cost. But the engineers were loath to abandon the idea. "The key to getting something accepted at Apple is to make it a fait accompli," Baker said. Only when the pressure from outsiders for lower-cost computers became overwhelming did Apple executives finally discover that such a machine was already well into development. As happened with both the original Macintosh and the Mac 2, the executives moved the once obscure project onto the fast track, and before 1990 was out, Apple finally had a series of low-cost Macintosh computers, including not only the Chung Baker Color LC, but a compact Mac, the Classic, built on similar principles. The Classic had all the power of the SE, but retailed for under $1,000. the price point envisioned by Jeff Raskin for his Swiss Army knife computer. The appearance of these economy models was one more boost to the momentum already generated for Macintosh. After taking almost 5 years to sell 1 million Macs, Apple would sell around 10 times that in the next half decade. It had taken until the 1990s, but Apple's lofty goal was finally reached. Macintosh was indisputably the third great standard in personal computerdom after the Apple II and DOS, and the only one that anyone but a wirehead could love. Chapter 10. "If I weren't in business," John Sculley once wrote, "I'd probably be an artist." Actually, Sculley believed he was an artist, a scientist, and a visionary. Apple's chairman in the post-Jobs era, born in 1940, had studied architecture at Brown University, but instead of designing buildings, he pursued an MBA at Wharton. After a brief tour at the McCann Erickson Advertising Agency, he went to work for PepsiCo. He had married the chairman's daughter and determinedly made his mark on the company, working on the Pepsi Generation campaign, reorganizing the snack foods division, masterminding the Pepsi Challenge. Later, he would speak about these tasks as if they were great works, but he must have known better. When Steve Jobs taunted him, "Do you want to sell sugared water for the rest of your life?" it marked a turning point for Sculley. Sculley's move to Silicon Valley in 1983, a journey the particulars of which he later accounted with Homeric gravity, was the opportunity to make his own dent in the universe. In the Silicon Valley, and at Apple in particular, bottom liners and suits were regarded by the true hackers as necessary evils, but irrelevant in the big scheme. Bozos. Sculley, who hated neckties anyway, resisted this characterization. Though he certainly demanded his corporate due, at a base salary of $2 million and millions more in stock options, his compensation boosted him high on the Business Week chart of most highly paid executives. He also sought recognition as a deep thinker, a scientist, the sort of guy who would vacation in Paris to hang out at the Louvre, and then, sketchbooks in hand, wander to the Left Bank. Sculley took pains to cite his own thwarted career as an inventor. By his own account, he had, at age 14, invented a color television cathode ray tube. But only 2 weeks before he filed his patent application, another inventor registered something similar, and this preemptive entry eventually wound up as the heart of Sony Trinitron technology. Sculley understood that he was particularly well-placed to assume the mantle of visionary since his company was making the most visionary product of its time, Macintosh. Though he did not really take easily to computer technology, close observers would note that when he used a new Macintosh application, his hand would literally shake with tension as he grasped the mouse. He did understand that his interface and friendliness were a quantum jump in personal computing. To John, the Mac interface was sort of the computer equivalent to the pull tab on a Pepsi can, said Joe Hutsko, who for a time was Sculley's personal technology tutor. Sculley knew that users hadn't begun to tap the Mac's potential. Desktop publishing was only the opening salvo of a fusillade of developments that would change the way people worked. But through 1985 and 1986, his thoughts about techno-cultural revolutions had to wait until Apple itself was stabilized. As he told an audience of industry luminaries in 1986, "The very best companies in the world are best not only because of their creativity, but because of their ability to implement." Apple, in growing up, has had to realize that this is an important priority for successful innovation, as important as the creative development of ideas. Compared to Apple's previous ethic, where nothing was prized more than wizardry, this was heresy. But it had to be said. The oft-repeated joke in Cupertino was, "What's the difference between Apple and Boy Scouts? The Boy Scouts have adult supervision." Sculley assumed the role of Scoutmaster. After the adults took charge, there would be plenty of time for creativity, for innovation, for vision. And Sculley was determined to be known as the architect of that vision. So, in late 1985, when Bill Atkinson went to John Sculley with an idea that dramatically enhanced the Macintosh's ability to handle information, the chairman and chief executive officer was a willing audience. The past few months had been dreary for Bill Atkinson. At first, the inventor of QuickDraw and the hero of MacPaint thought he had avoided the post-Macintosh depression, paralyzing many of his peers. Capitalizing on the freedom accorded him as an Apple Fellow, he embarked on a project as potentially transforming as those previous achievements. He called it Magic Slate. As Atkinson later explained to me, this was the latest iteration of Alan Kay's dream, the Dynabook. It was to be a flat panel of liquid crystal display, about the size and heft of a few legal pads, perhaps an inch thick and weighing no more than a pound, but it would store enough information to equal an 80-foot tower of notebooks. The device would be manufactured cheaply and sold at a very low cost. How low? Low enough that we figure you could lose 6 of them in a year and not be hurting, Atkinson said. Magic Slate's paradigm was the page. Each screenful represented a page of information. You turn these virtual pages by swiping at the bottom of the screen, the same motion you use to flip a page in a notebook. There would be no mouse or keyboard. A touch-sensitive screen itself would be your control device. You would write with a stylus, and your scrawl would be instantly recognized and translated into a clean screen font, ready for editing or digital storage. One more chunk of the data sphere. When Atkinson told me this, I stopped writing in my own no-tech notebook, a stenopad purchased earlier in the day, and showed him my own scrawl, a script so illegible that only hours after taking notes, I am often stymied in deciphering the words. Could it read this? I asked. Without an instant's pause, Atkinson nodded vigorously. I wanted Magic Slate so bad I could taste it, Atkinson said. But as the case with Dynabook, the idea was too far ahead of reality. He believed Magic Slate would be possible if Apple had been inclined to pursue long-range research that could develop the requisite new technologies. Apple, though, was more concerned about fixing Macintosh and boosting its short-term revenues than in pioneering a new concept of product, especially one that even by optimistic estimates would take years to bring to fruition. Magic Slate died. Atkinson was devastated. While he considered it satisfying to concoct new technology, the exercise seemed pointless if his ideas were not realized and offered for sale in the digital bazaar. I bought Steve's dream, he said, making a dent in the universe. For months, Atkinson immersed himself in a numbing void. He spent his days at home, too disheartened to even turn on his computer. One night, he stumbled out of his house in the Los Gatos Hills, wandering aimlessly. The night was cloudless, gorgeous. He spent hours gazing into the sky. Suddenly, his own troubles fell in perspective. Who was he? A stray pixel in the eternal bitmap. There was no way the human beings were alone in this universe, he thought. No way that we're the pinnacle of all possible life forms. The thought was oddly encouraging. Given this fact, it seemed to him, the important thing was what one could do. Could you aid your fellow humans, enhance their abilities, make a contribution? Bill Atkinson realized that more than most, he could. He was in a position of leadership. He was a world-class thinker, a right-brained adept. And, thanks to his feats at Apple, he had the ear of John Sculley. Following this epiphany, his creative floodgates flew open, and soon he had resurrected some of the concepts of Magic Slate into software that could be quickly realized on a Macintosh. This new program exchanged the page paradigm for one based on cards, an endless stack of 3x5s. The information on these cards would not be limited to text. They could store anything that could be held in digital format, which meant nearly anything: text, graphics, sound, even video. But the most important part of the program would be the manner in which the various cards of information were grafted to each other. At the merest suggestion of a sensible juxtaposition, a user of Atkinson's program could link any card to any other. A series of links would result in an information pathway that harkened back to the dreams of Vannevar Bush, whose influential Gedanken experiment, MEMEX, was characterized by the data trails that would be cleared by the scientists and researchers using it. As it turns out, Atkinson was not the only one at work on realizing Bush's vision. The MEMEX vision, of course, had originally ignited Douglas Engelbart, who in turn triggered the series of innovations that would lead to Macintosh. But the most vocal proponent of Bush's ideas was Ted Nelson. For years, Nelson had been a peripatetic, if somewhat cranky, figure in the clubby personal computer underground. He was known mainly for the iconoclastic populism of his self-described 1974 book, Computer Lib, Dream Machines, in which he made a strident and at times hilarious case for truly personal computers. Nelson had long been an advocate of an electronic publishing industry. We ought to be able to read and write on computer screens with vast libraries easily, instantly, and clearly available to us, he declared in an underappreciated book called Literary Machines, long before it was fashionable to express such things. The key to accessing this information, said Nelson, was the use of what he called hypertext, or non-sequential writing. Nelson's dream for implementing this was, and remains, Xanadu, a complicated system in perpetual development. Vannevar Bush would have approved of Xanadu's key idea, treating the accumulated knowledge of the world as a single body and providing access to it via a series of dynamic links under the control of the individual. A literature is a system of interconnected writings, Nelson wrote, held together by a flux of invisible thread and rubber bands. While certain experimental novelists, Julio Cortazar with Hopscotch, Lawrence Stern with Tristram Shandy, had toyed with this notion, Nelson insisted that leaping from document to document was the essential way to partake of the world's ideas. He even outlined a scheme by which copyright fees could be collected by creators of the brief info gems whose words found themselves on the linked path to enlightenment. Such ideas were furiously percolating in Silicon Valley in the mid-1980s, but it took Atkinson writing a program for Macintosh to give them form and substance. He thought his program, which he called Wildcard, could be the ultimate organizer. As often happens in the computer industry, the proposed product name had been claimed by a previous company, and the program came to be known as HyperCard. After observing the trademark battles in the computer industry for some years, I now envision the English language as a lexical Oklahoma territory, each word waiting for a homesteader to stake a claim on it. HyperCard was meant to occupy a central place in the world of Macintosh, a node from which would tumble all the weird facts, semi-remembered appointments, and quickly jotted phone numbers that all too often had previously gotten lost in the shuffle of information clutter. It would be a virtual cockpit. By pushing its buttons and tweaking its instruments, one could retrieve the aggregate wisdom of cyberspace, the equivalent of the libraries of Alexandria, all accessible from a familiar home card that automatically appeared when you opened the program. As was the Macintosh itself, HyperCard was a tool that could affect the way you viewed information. By its quick and painless linking process, one could easily see how all sorts of disparate forms of information could be linked to each other. Atkinson had a test program with a number of scanned and hand-drawn images. Several featured people wearing hats. If you pressed the cursor on a hat, you would find other images on other cards appearing, linked by the visual concept of hats. Lurking behind that activity was an idea that information could easily migrate across the boundaries of text, graphics, video, and sound.